Today we're doing I'm Sick, What Should I Do? As kind of a book title to the presentation today and to our discussions today. But let me just read with you, because it's been said that the green pen does not show up very well in the back of the room. And so it reads that the central ethic of Christian love, agape, has caused our religion, and this is a historical statement, as well as a current one, to be, to be the leader in taking a holistic or a whole person approach to the quality of human life, period. Thus, and this is of course where we're going, individuals, congregations, and communities where Christians are, and the governments, local, state, and federal, that they support, should reflect not a stranger or a standoff or a distant relationship with those in need of health care, but rather one of concern and compassion. And it is around that central statement that my daughter Leah and I, who we identified ourselves, but for the benefit of the new people, I'm a retired pastor and hospital administrator. Leah is a PhD candidate at UCLA in the field that we built this series. And with that introduction, and with the welcoming in of our folks over here, and we're going to turn to Leah first of all today and talk about, as I said, we titled the session, I'm Sick, What Should I Do? The overall concern today is access to the healthcare field. So with that, we'll ask Leah to step forward and do her thing.
There's a little bit of a misnomer in I'm Sick, What Should I Do? And I hope that in shortening our title, we didn't confuse people. We really want to talk today about accessing the healthcare system, but more specifically, you might have had a chance to look at this chart up here. What's the difference between people's access? Looking at some statistics so we get a better feel of how people use the healthcare system. Not just, I'm sick, I have a cold, should I go to this doctor or that doctor? It's a little different than that. Let me tell you also that I'm going to err on the side of giving you a little bit more information than less. I feel that we have a really with it crowd, and so when I was putting this together, I thought it's probably easier for you to stop and say, wait, you need to back up a little bit, than to have you sit here and be bored. So let me start off with defining what access is. In its simplicity, access is basically the actual use of personal health services and everything that facilitates or impedes the use of your services. Or another way of saying this is the timely use of personal health services to achieve your best possible health outcome. You may be less sick or less well than someone else, but you're using healthcare as you need to, okay? Having said that, I think one of the reasons we wanted to put this series together was because everyone knows, and if you read the papers and watch the news and are on top of sort of what's going on in the healthcare industry, that we have a lot of problems with our healthcare system in terms of the financial burden and covering all the people that we have in healthcare, our four healthcare services. And everyone pretty much agrees that we should change. But when you get everybody in a single room, like we're going to tonight for the healthcare forum, you're going to hear about, everyone has a different opinion on how to fix the healthcare system. Tonight, like I said, we're going to have this forum where people are going to share, anyone can come and talk about their experience in accessing the healthcare system. So those of you who are here might be armed with a little bit more information when you go tonight. But a lot of people would like to see our healthcare system changed. On one side, they want to see it changed by cutting government programs, pushing things towards the private market for profit, letting the market basically take care of itself, figuring that we'll all have insurance, we'll all be able to get the health care we need. On the other side, there are people who say that we should have a single payer system, that we should all work, pay into the government as if it were one large insurance company, And then the government would take care of providing our health care. So you get a lot of people in between, but you get both sides of this debate going on. A good place to start, therefore, is talking about access in the way people can use health services, or in essence, the way you as a person have the ability to use health services. There are three reasons why studying the measures of access are important, and this is really the basis of the whole talk today, and that is, one, that when you understand how people use health services, you can actually measure and predict the amount. It seems pretty simple, but you realize we need to get a good understanding of how much people are using health services in different parts of the country and by their age and race. Secondly, which has a lot to do with our theme at Holden, is we want to look at how access or the use of health services promotes social justice. If we can measure access, we can therefore make a more equitable society because we want everyone to be able to use them like the more fortunate. And three, we want people to be healthy. We want them to have good quality health care. And unless we do some sort of tracking, how are we going to know who's not getting health care and who is? So another way of measuring access, or another point of it, is to look at health outcomes and quality. So when we talk a little bit about measuring access to predict health services use, I want to tell you two different phrases you'll hear. You'll hear potential access and realized access. And the reason this is important when we talk about measuring the use of services is that you may live in a community that has 10 hospitals, that has plenty of doctors, physicians, nurses, health technicians, but you still may not get to realize or in essence go there. There are a lot of people who don't have the ability to walk into that place and get the care they need. It's an important element for policy because they can either increase or decrease the use by certain rules or legislative action. The second way of looking at measuring access and promoting social justice is equitable versus inequitable access. So it's important to see who in the playing field is getting care, because if there seems to be a very inequitable distribution of services, we've seen our government step in and create programs like Medicare and Medicaid and various uninsured programs or charity programs to try to raise the level and make it an equal playing field so that everybody can have access to care. And then you hear the words a lot, efficient and effective. And all that really is saying is, are we spending our money the right way? We talked a little bit about that yesterday, and that maybe should we be sending people, getting them out of the ER and into a better place? Should we be working on their health, stopping them from smoking and weight control, instead of wasting our money and waiting till they're very, very sick? And so looking at access in all of these different ways, you realize it draws a much better picture for what it is we're trying to make decisions about in providing health care to our community. I wrote this up here ahead of time because it's pretty detailed, but I just want to show you some trends. There's not very much difference here in the years. We're only talking 13 years, from 1980 to 1993, for each of these columns. But you can see where our problems are stemming, why our system is getting more expensive, why there's a lot of inequity in the system, and why that we're beginning sort of an us versus them mentality between who gets care and who doesn't. So let's just walk through this briefly. One of the things that's important to see is that in this column, we're talking about people with private health insurance. So in health insurance through your employer, usually HMOs, PPOs, even the old-fashioned indemnity insurance, which means when you go for care, they get paid. There's not this managing your care, and it's basically the way insurance companies used to work. You would go and the doctor would get paid every time they saw you, so cost basis, okay? These are people with private insurance, usually considered the best insured. These are people with Medicaid. Okay, so in essence, the safety net program of the government. Interestingly, you have to remember, Medicaid is not a program in our government that covers everyone if you're uninsured. It covers, it's a means test, or in essence, you have to meet certain criteria to be Medicaid eligible. which is the problem we have in this country, because we have a very large pocket of uninsured people. Sometimes these people are called the working poor, because these people often have part-time jobs or very low-paying full-time jobs, maybe a couple dollars an hour, minimum wage. California, we see a lot of this because we get a lot of agricultural workers, people who don't have insurance through their employers. So this is considered the working poor, and often they even have more money than the Medicaid people. However, the Medicaid often have insurance because of their poverty level, and the uninsured don't. We're going to get a little bit more into the details of these things when we talk about who pays for the bill, but I think the important thing we want to talk about is the difference between the way these people get care, okay? And most importantly, what's happened over the last 13 years. If you notice, the children in our country, they're pretty much some of the worst off, unfortunately. Our private insurance for them is slipping. Their parents don't have private insurance as much as they used to, and they're not covered. They're not dependents on this insurance like they used to be. It used to be 10% of our children in this country were covered.
I was going to say, could you say the numbers?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's probably hard to see.
Yeah.
75% of the children in 1980 had private insurance, or were, in essence, dependents on their parents' insurance. In 93, it's only 66%, so only two-thirds of our children. This is reflected, obviously, then, in the next two columns. Medicaid covers, for the children under 15, it used to cover 10% of our nation's children. It's up to now 20%, and some of the statistics are that it's much higher than this. This is a conservative number.
But that's 4 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. It's nearing up to 25-27% now of our children are on Medicaid. And worse yet, these children at least get services because they have the government paying for them. Our uninsured children are increasing as well. They're going up, their parents are uninsured, they're uninsured, and because the parents, it's a catch-22, because the parents make enough money, then they don't qualify for Medicaid, and so therefore they have no insurance at all. Okay? You'll see this in what often is called for women as childbearing years, years that people are basically healthy, but they have maintenance needs, women of pregnancy years, but this 15 to 44 also are slipping. Private insurance, this is also a very, obviously, these no longer dependents as much, they're working on their own. Slipping a bit from 79% in 80 to 71%. And you see that that's picked up, and then a few more are on Medicaid, it's up 6%. And many more are uninsured, unfortunately, okay? And then I haven't put 65 and above on here because of our Medicare program, and we'll be talking about that later in a different session. Obviously, most people are covered by Medicare. There are some exceptions, but we'll talk about that a little bit later. But in our later adult years, before Medicare clicks in, we also have a bit of a decrease, a drop in about 3% of those covered by private insurance, holding about the same for Medicaid. But you see the difference is that if they drop their private insurance, they're probably still working, don't qualify for Medicaid, and have become uninsured. All right?
Well, that also probably has to do with the trend for earlier retirement. When people are quitting work, and that without thinking that, oh my goodness, I'm giving up my health insurance. Then it doesn't kick in until they're 65.
That may be. Hopefully those people that have the wherewithal to retire early, hopefully they also have the income to buy health insurance, but maybe not.
Maybe not.
Now this is where you see some drastic differences as well. You see the white population and the black population. I didn't have very good numbers for the Hispanic. They only have started to be collected. But in 1980, 82% of the whites had private insurance, while 60% of the black population had private insurance. We'll see a drop in both from 93, 75% of whites, 51% of blacks. Medicaid has always been more blacks than whites, 18% versus 3% of the whites. But you see the big increase here that we have 24% of the blacks in 1993 are on Medicaid, and 7% of the white population. And this includes children and adults. The uninsured, again,
have been traditionally more black than white. However, we even see that continuing, that process continuing. So as the whites grow and uninsured, so do the black population. And then here we get a little bit into income. And income has been, in all studies, income has been the number one reason why people have health insurance. That seems logical, but unfortunately, it's also one of the harder things to change through programs, cash subsidies, whatever. But income makes a big difference as to whether you have private insurance. You can see here, 39% in 1980, under $14,000, who made $14,000 or less, had private insurance, whereas those who made $50,000 or more, 94% of them had private insurance. That holds about constant. You can see there's not much difference. And in fact, as you would expect, people who are making a lot of money aren't really on Medicaid. You see them choosing or opting to be uninsured. And whereas these numbers, again, are pretty expected. The poorest people are also the ones filling up the Medicaid ranks, and they're also the greatest number who are uninsured. So that chart basically is a good way of starting to understand that social characteristics or our demographics, in essence, put us in categories or in danger of not getting the right access to healthcare. So when we talk about social justice, we talk about promoting health services use, you realize we have to work with some very difficult things about people that you can't change. You just can't change your race. You just can't change your income status like that. And those are very good predictors, or in essence, reasons why you're not getting the care that you should be getting. Okay. Break. So it's this kind of thing people have been looking at, trying to research, and it's also, would you do me a favor, would you erase that?
Yep.
It is also, this is where people want to make the changes. This is where programs like the state programs and the government and the federal programs come in, where people say, we can change this. We have the ability to raise up different populations to make it more equitable. And therefore, we've seen changes in Medicaid. We've seen changes in Medicare to try to level the playing field a little bit. Okay.
We got a floppy board here.
Yeah. One of the things that we got a lot of interest in our last session yesterday was to talk about preventive services. And one of the clear indications that keeps people healthy is, again, that they have preventive health care. Well, preventive health care is extremely dependent on your income and all of those factors that are on there. You see people in lower socioeconomic status having worse health habits, and in essence needing more assistance, sometimes costs more money, and they're less able to use those services, all right? We saw Medicaid basically first very much help the poor in accessing healthcare. It changed the way our system delivered care. The same thing happened with the Medicare people. The Medicare recipients, there was a big boom in the number of elderly that were able to get health care. Some of those gains now are not working as well, and this is where a lot of the legislation is being proposed to change the access. I don't know how many of you are aware that the states have a lot of ability to change the Medicaid laws, and many of them are changing them to either make people more or less able to get care. And you're probably aware that the Medicare laws are also going to be changed, or may be changed by Congress, raising the age limit. Instead, we're used to thinking 65, it might go up to 67 or 70, it depends. And it also might change in terms of income, because they look at statistics and they say, hey, our higher income elderly probably have more access, so we need to help the lower income. Whether that's true or not, whether it happens or not, you can see they use these kind of statistics to figure out how to make these adjustments and get the right people care. So I have another really small chart that I want to see if there's some strange statistics that you might not think about. Go going in certain directions. For instance, hospital visits. In 1928, 1974, and 1993.
You might say, Leah, that one of the reasons, it seems 1993 is a long time ago.
I'm sorry.
But yeah. The government is just absolutely tardy about gathering healthcare statistics. We just, those of us that work in the healthcare field, we say to the government, we want more current information. We want more current information, but somehow or other, as it gets processed through the bureaucracy, we in operations and in the field itself are always dealing with somewhat tardy statistics. So if you wonder why Lee is dealing with 93, those are firm statistics that we can count on as being reliable, but it does take that long to get statistics, and they still do show trends, so we think
they show trends. And the other problem is that the government has sets of statistics, but you realize private organizations, whether they be hospitals, healthcare institutions, or a company making cars, they don't want to let their competitors know and people know exactly how many people they're treating, so they're very reluctant to give these things out. So it often takes a couple of years until people can do the calculations and figure out who's doing what. But the private institutions hold this data very close. So, having talked a little bit about what we have, I'm curious to see if you can predict if in 1928, there's the reason, the way this is calculated is admissions per 100 people. So of every 100 people in a low income category, six of them were using healthcare, six of them were admitted, and the high-income people, eight of them are admitted. Well, you would expect in 1928, most of these people were paying for care out of their pockets, right? So the high-income people were able to pay a little bit more, probably go to the hospital a little bit more. However, the low-income people, there was a more charity care system set up by the churches, various city organizations. So we saw a little bit more equality in the care that was delivered. However, very different style. These people were in wards of 25 people, and these people had very private rooms, maid service for all you know. Where do you think this went in 74? How many people were being admitted to hospitals, low versus high income? Any guess? Let's say low income first. More or less in 1974?
Went up.
More?
How about 19? So our reliance on hospitals for the low-income people shot way up. Now, there's lots of reasons for that. We built more hospitals. There's a lot more hospitals. But also, there was an effort. Medicaid was started in 65. So there was an effort to get these people care and bring them into the hospitals. How about for the high-income people? It went up, but not as much. Now, how about in 93, or let's just say
today? Does the hospital include ER?
These are people who are actually admitted. So they're in for some reason, they're actually staying overnight. Yep. In 93, or in today's world, where do you expect this to have gone?
Went down.
It did go down for both. But the interesting thing is we see still a very big trend in the difference between low-income and high-income people in the way they use healthcare and the way the doctors tell them to use healthcare. Mm-hmm. High-income people don't want to often sit in the hospital, but low-income people get put into the hospital a lot for various reasons, good and bad. They may get better care there. There may not be as many people at home. They may not have the money. However, sometimes people are put into a hospital because it's just the easiest thing to do. Okay? How about physician visits? This is just number of physician visits in 1 year. It started out with the low-income people at about 2.2 versus 4.3 for the high-income. Where do you think it went in 74? Think it went up? It definitely went up. Because again, people started having insurance to pay for these things. Here, it didn't quite go up as much. Went up 5 from 4.3 to 5. So people in high income kind of always had the money to see a doctor. So instead, they were still only using them as they might need to. Here it kind of shows up there's pent-up need or demand. So the minute they have someone paying for their health care, they're often their access increases and they start to use the institutions and physicians. Now, interestingly, this continues to rise, and this is one of the main concerns of people. Why are low-income people using so much health care?
It's lack of health education, that low income is associated with education. And I think they're not having the same kind of general education that higher income people have. They have higher income people have more time to read.
What does education do for them?
Well, it teaches them how to take care of their own health rather than having to go to a health professional.
Mm-hmm. Any other comment?
We have a saying in obstetrics, we're always a generation behind. If we had healthy moms, we'd have healthy babies. But until we get a generation of healthy moms, we're going to have healthy, sick babies. The sick babies are going to be sick moms. And until we can, and I don't know the answer, but we've got to have healthy moms if we're going to break this cycle.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Also, I think that people who are more poor tend to wait longer sometimes to get health care because of not being able to afford it. So then when they do need it, they really have to go into the hospital.
That's right. That's exactly right. And that's part of the education problem, but it also has been shown that they just do not have the luxury income to take vacations, to live in clean environments. They live in overcrowded apartments. I mean, their situation sets them up to be sicker, as well as, even if they know, even if they read something and say, I don't want to be here, they often don't have the means to change that.
They may not eat as well.
All kinds of things.
Absolutely.
You go to the grocery store and see the way they eat.
Yes, sir.
Do your statistics show for the low-income people how many are immigrants?
Some studies have been done to show that, and the ethnic minorities in our country are by far at a greater disadvantage than the white population, yes.
And
much of that is based in income
and, they keep
and insurance.
And they keep coming.
Because they get better care.
And they keep coming. However, if you are an Asian immigrant and you have private insurance through your employer and you make money, you know, your income is higher, you are most likely have the same health status as a white citizen. It is so dependent on your socioeconomic status.
That's true, but the most that are coming in are the low income.
That's true.
So there's where we're getting an increase in that situation.
That's true.
That may account for some of that increase over there on the right-hand side.
That's true, and in California, this is again, since that's where I live, I'm very familiar with their situation. This is a very big issue for them. This is where you've read about the legislation about stopping all state services to undocumented, because generally they're tapping into the services more, you know, here. They're tapping in more than those who are more fortunate. And because they are not citizens, we feel that it's not our responsibility. Again, big debate, but that is a huge number of people who are using the services, which is why I wanted to show you this, because you can see how this stratification makes a big difference between income.
What about the migrant workers? I went to that movie, the film last night, and it's just incredible to think that I'm sure they don't have many health services at all.
Mm-mm.
And they do hard work and they live in these horrible conditions. Well, their health must be horrible.
It is. It's horrible.
But there's a flip side to that. I don't know how old, I didn't go to the movie, I don't know how old it is.
A year old.
It was made.
Just a year old.
But the story I heard coming from Wenatchee Airport to Chelan by the taxi driver, and we were talking about the community, and I was asking him how apples are picked, and the ladders go up, and the migrants come, and the cherries, same way. And he said, in the old days, they used to come up and then go back, Mexico, I suppose, go leave. But in recent years, our government now, through government programs, in the housing and in food stamps, etc., the migrants now are staying in Wenatchee, in the area, and the town has tripled in size since 72. All I'm just saying that. That's all I know is what he told me.
And what it has done to the health care in that area,
in that Wenatchee community. There's been that change.
There may be people who would argue that isn't it the Wenatchee Apple Company's responsibility to provide appropriate benefits to their employees. Now, again, these are all things to think about, and the decisions that legislators or policymakers have to make, whether we make that a law or whether we go with the private market and we say it's up to that employer to decide to give those people health benefits. But there are a lot of people who say how unfair of the company to be using these people, low-level wages, without giving them the rights that we all enjoy working for companies who do provide benefits. So, again, an issue of debate, but just another hand. Oh, Grace.
Well, and we of the church have to have a large voice to those governmental people that you speak of who make policies and laws. Because as I was driving through and saw this lovely, it's not brick, but it's kind of like that, anyway, building where migrants are housed. And years ago, and I grew up in a farming community where migrants came in and they would just live in little tiny trailers, 4 or 5 families, and think of the disease possibilities in those. I just was like appalled and thought to myself and actually said to the person in the car, now that has much improved the dwelling that is being provided for the migrant workers. And as a Christian, I still come out with a large question in terms of when we talk about justice, when we talk about equality, on the economic side, I can certainly say, well, certainly, they're migrant workers, and they're enjoying earning minimum wage here, and then perhaps they go back or not. But when I look at what are we doing in terms of encouraging equality of life, I thought that I'd just go, I have to ponder this a long time, because I'm not satisfied in saying that those statistics are appropriate in terms of a Christian response. Because two, I don't know if you have any statistics on back in 1928, how many of the hospitals were run by the church compared to how many of them were offered by the community. I know that I'm a deaconess, and deaconess ministry started in the hospitals.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I said, in this time, there were two kinds of churches. Hospitals. Very private, luxury hospitals, one-on-one care, and hospitals that, there's a pretty good reputation, actually. They were charity, very church-based, community-based, and that's why these people were getting care to begin with. The government really had very little to do with providing care at that point. It was from the charity of the community.
But they were county hospitals.
There were county hospitals, and that's mostly where people went to die.
In some cities. Some city. My first hospital.
Hold on.
Sorry.
Oh, we forgot. We need time to go back.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Where are you?
I don't know. You can go from there.
Okay. Well, I was just going to say that the first hospital that I served as an administrator, kind of interesting that the city-owned hospital, the church had a little difficulty with having one of their ordained pastors be administrator of a city hospital. But that was a city-owned hospital and was established 1924. and had as a regular, had right in the charter of the hospital when he got started, that and this was before Hill Burton mandated any percentage of care or any dollars of care, but we had right in the charter that a certain percentage of our care had to be given, however it be financed, to the poor and indigent. So let's see your dental.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to make a comment about the Old City Hospital because I worked at the Hennepin County Medical Center before they built the new one.
Right.
And, you know, it was one of the most efficient uses of nursing I've ever seen because we did have 25 people in a ward, but you didn't need so many nurses because you could see what was going on. I don't know what else I was going to say about that, but it was real efficient, and now we put everybody in private or double rooms. It takes a lot more nurses to go around and do what they need to do.
Right.
So there is a downside to the modern hospital.
Right. Well, to finish up this, dental is often used as a good example of luxury money, because even those of us who have the money to spend either don't like going to the dentist, often don't have dental insurance. It's something we pay out of pocket. So it's something that's very temperamental to how much extra money we have and how conscientious we are to take care of our own health and stay ahead, in essence, preventive medicine. Now, for dental, the way this is measured is how many people saw a dentist in the last year, okay? In 1928, 10% of the low-income people saw a dentist in a year, whereas 40% saw one in the high income. 1974, yes?
She has the question. That's at least once a year or just once a year?
They asked a question, and the question is, have you seen a dentist in the last year? Do you think it went up in 74? More people seeing a dentist?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You're right. For both, 35% of people saw a dentist in the last year, whereas 64% of the high income people did. And how about 93?
Yeah.
For low income?
Yes.
No. We still only have 35% of our low income people seeing a dentist in the previous year, unfortunately. And for high-income people, this has continued to rise. We're probably near 85 to 90%. Big difference. And talk about preventive care. I mean, that's just good health. Okay.
Again, the question is, and maybe it's beyond what we're getting into today.
All right, well,
that's okay, we'll tell you.
Our church, the Lutheran church, and everybody, we say we have the hospitals, we have all this. At the end of the line that the secular hospitals have, what is the church doing about promoting preventive care?
Let's answer first a couple of questions. The Lutheran church does not have the Lutheran Church, as I recall now, and I'll have to be corrected on this, but I'm pretty close to being right. The Lutheran Church has two hospitals right now that are official ELCA hospitals: Lutheran General in Park Ridge, Illinois, and Lutheran Hospital in Brooklyn, New York. And I believe that those are the only two. Fairview Hospital in Minneapolis has a sort of tangential relationship with the Lutheran Church. 28 congregations of the former ALC are the parenting body organization, and it is just a nominal relationship. So there aren't very many Lutheran hospitals. That's just an aside statistics. On the other hand, and I'll talk while Leah's putting up this next chart for you. On the other hand, in the long-term care field, which we are going to deal with, and we may readjust our schedule at some people's suggestions and include more about long-term care later or earlier into our program, just an aside. But for a kudo to the Lutheran Church, there has always been a high social consciousness in the Lutheran Church, and it has emerged in the form of long-term care institutions. The Lutheran social service agencies and the Lutheran long-term care organizations, which have just recently been merged. Missouri Synod is just thinking about being a participating member in an organization called ALMSO, the American Lutheran something or other, it all stands for. But it is the largest, both by a number of organizations and by dollar amounts, the largest organization of social service concerns and long-term care organizations in the United States. So by providing both services and by the long-term care institutions, while certainly not being content about what we're doing pretty good in those areas. We've got much to do.
We're getting on the right track.
But back to the acute side, we're not doing much. The question is, are we structured to do something about preventative work? And I think, not to let us off the hook, but recall with me, please, if you can remember, that the concept of preventative care is comparatively new in the United States and emerged with the concern, the economics, financial concerns that arose as much as it did with people being concerned about their own health. Their payment mechanisms swung in, saw an opportunity. If we kept people well, it will cost us less, and therefore, not only has the church witnessed the fact that people should be well in body, mind, and soul, but the impetus has been from those financial organizations that said, aha, and it will cost less of us to do that.
Grace? I would just like to add that, like AAL, and I'm an AAL person, right?
What does that stand for?
It's a Lutheran insurance company.
Association.
Yeah, I just know what plan I have. I don't know what the company's called. But anyway, they're doing preventative, encouraging preventative health care, too, because in our packets, there's a lot of information about, you know, stopping smoking, losing weight, dealing with grief, dealing with stress. And there's a lot more encouragement to be preventative in that arena.
That's right.
Right.
Jim.
Yeah, part of that, part of the movement is, I don't know if you're going to get into this, but there is a whole health ministry movement in the churches where you have a parish nurse and you have a health ministry committee and then you education. You get into that?
Yeah. He's actually going to do a session on
that. And we, number of churches do that. We have something in the Bay Area called Bay Area Health Ministries, and you join it and pay a membership fee each year, and you get their publications and all kinds of stuff.
Yep. Did you have a question?
Oh, that's what I was going to mention.
I'm going to leave you with, one, a hint about how we're structuring this course series. Two, a way of putting this together in your head. And three, something that maybe will help you think through healthcare and when I say healthcare, I mean staying well and being a part of your community, not just using a hospital. This is a model that actually someone very famous in the healthcare industry has come up with, but I think it's probably the best way of describing the way things work together. And yesterday we talked about the environment, or in essence, our healthcare system. We didn't talk a whole lot about our culture because we only have 45 minutes, really. We could go on and on and on about various things, and we could take each one of these boxes and spend weeks on it. So we touched on the environment in which we live, how healthcare is organized, the institutions and people who provide us healthcare. So first you got to build that framework, okay? The next step, which we really are talking about today, are the characteristics of our population. And that we must recognize that depending on these characteristics, we use healthcare differently. It's nice to say everyone should have equal healthcare, everyone should do the same thing, but people use healthcare differently. There are some expressions. Predisposing characteristics are things like race, family network, church. So they predispose them, in essence. Enabling are things like insurance, healthcare. And the one thing we haven't talked about today, that just in brief, is need. There are two kinds of need. If you think about this, I don't know if this has ever crossed your mind, but one is what you think you need, and two is what your doctor or a professional thinks you need. They can be very different things. Have you opened the newspaper or magazines lately and seen advertisements for pharmaceuticals directed right at you? Go ask your doctor for this pill. They're changing, the market's changing. It's trying to not only make you be more responsible for your healthcare, but it's also trying to make you be a bigger consumer sometimes of healthcare. Okay? Oh, you need a certain heart drug, you need a certain, and of course you need the most expensive one because it's the best. So there are very different kinds of need, and these needs are called evaluated need, which comes from the outside, someone looking at you, taking your temperature, saying, this is what I think you need, or your perceived need, sometimes called want. What you want in healthcare. Those of us who have more money and are very fortunate sometimes want a lot of healthcare. Okay? So that's a very big characteristic that culture drives, the environment drives. If there is no hospital in your environment, I can guarantee you, you'll all go to the hospital a lot less. You know? So you've got to have the structure set up. But then you also have to have the need evaluated, whether you have insurance, and whether your culture, your family basically believes in taking pills or doesn't believe in taking pills. So that's kind of where we are today. This is talking about access, or in essence, how do different people use the healthcare system? Yeah.
You made just a brief mention there toward the end about the advertising and so forth. Just think of the difference in our lives with cigarettes. And Christians were smoke up a stoner.
Sure.
And they used to when I was growing up, but I did too. And we didn't even know what was going on. And before it was considered immoral for a school teacher in my hometown to be caught smoking in public.
Mm.
Immoral. But anyway, they didn't want married teachers. Anyone was single. But having said all that, there we were. And we were butterfat, huh? All of that. We were clogging up our arteries to a fair degree.
Sure.
Now, we could say Christians, maybe they didn't understand. Well, I know we didn't understand what was going on medically. Maybe I'm jumping way ahead. But I want to
that next call there.
Okay.
But I just want to say that if society can change our minds with regard to a big word like cholesterol and cigarettes, then I think why don't we roll on with other situations?
Yep. And that's a lot of what you're talking about here has driven, and our laws, all of these external environmental things have driven our, not necessarily maybe our predisposing characteristics, we still will be the race we're born into, but it has very much driven our enabling characteristics, whether we have health insurance, whether our elderly are covered by Medicare, and our need, what we perceive we need versus, don't be fooled. Physicians, they're human beings and they have opinions and judgments. They will decide for you what you need. They may be right, they may sometimes be wrong. That's why your need or your perceived need is an important balance against what a physician says you need. And that's why they encourage you to work together. So, nicely, this is ending up today. Some of your interest, and because we had such good feedback yesterday, I thought it might be helpful to put this up. Because where we're moving is if you look at the culture and the system that we work in. Then you take the population's characteristics, very diverse, you know, very complicated tables, you're white, you're this age, you have this much income, but you put all of those together, it drives our health behavior, okay? And our health behavior can be separated in two ways. The way we actually use healthcare, that kind of health behavior, and the way we, let's say, live our life, so our lifestyle. These things all will drive our health behavior, okay? And it is from this that we're going to talk about quality, status of life, health status, death with dignity, you know, death, all these things that are outcomes. You either get well, you die, you're somewhere in between. But what's your definition of quality? Okay? Now, if you really look at this model, can't you start seeing things like, well, our culture's going to tell us what we think about death, right? And our enabling characteristics in life are going to affect the way we live our life. And our outcome, say we have cancer, we are very, very sick, we stay alive, but our quality of life has diminished. Maybe we're in a wheelchair, something's happened. So our outcome is going to affect this, and it's going to affect our use of health services. You can start drawing arrows to a lot of different boxes here. So it's going to be our goal, in essence, to get you through this, but to have you realize that these boxes, lines, are very transparent, that your health status and your attitudes are affect the way you use healthcare as well. Okay. Any other questions?
Okay. Well,
I think we do have a question.
Okay, good.
Yeah, once upon a time, way back beyond most people in this room, there was the old doctor book. And if you didn't feel well, you didn't go to the doctor where you showed back, you know, way back, low physician visits. You went to the doctor's book and read instead. And then over time, we got much more dependent on the health professional. That was dependent on health professional, sure. It had to be written by one, but I mean, we made some decisions on our own. The interesting thing is that the HMOs that I purchase for our employees, or make available for them, and we pay for it, have gotten back to a degree to that old doctor's book.
That's true. Yeah.
And they are publishing care books so that you don't need access again. But then that depends on the ability to read and understand. And that gets us back to the poverty level where there's inadequate education.
Education or you or somebody else raised with regard. Well, you don't have to go back to that old book. When we had children, including Leah, we had Dr. Spock. Didn't you all have Dr. Spock?
Sure,
When you had children, we all had Dr. Spock to raise our kids. So, but we know what you mean. Yes, sir.
You were talking about attitudes. Will you bring out, and I presume there's a difference, the difference between Christian attitudes and secular attitudes and how they relate and how we end up in that?
Now, we had a little debate about, or I had a little internal debate because I was handling that side of our preparation for this. It's a whole social justice, a whole psychology of religion, a theology of care type of thing. The question was whether and we found out from the program director and the education people that most of you are here for 1 week. And they gave us a 2 week stint. And the question was, how are we going to handle this? How are we going to put into 1 week an admittedly too broad subject for us to deal with? So we kind of put that in the second week, and if you're gone, the suggestion last night at the meeting of the teachers was that if you see what we're going to be talking about the second week, and you like or you want to know something about that, and it wasn't included in the first week, you should buy the tapes, because the tapes are, what, about $5.50 or something like that, because some of the subjects are just can't be handled in the scope of 1 week.
And
one of the questions, but because of our statement here, we're going to try to work those into some of those concepts. We don't know whether we're dealing with
adequate. Eternal life makes a difference in how we're going to feel.
Dan?
Yeah.
That will, the issue of Christian versus secular, and I think even other religions. Well, not
versus, but how Christian thinking helps
right.
us.
Comes up, Grace, you made a great comment today about access and about how Christian communities need to think. So on one hand, we hope to bring up issues under each of our topics. But, as he was saying, he is going to actually devote, when you speak of death, or very difficult decisions that one, forget death, very difficult decisions
yeah,
people need to make.
But even before death, if you're a Christian, right. maybe you'll live a more healthier life and a happier life than a secular person. Is this true? I'm asking.
Sure. Well, we know, and the Christian Church has, Augsburg, for instance, one of our publishing houses, has been a leader in publishing some books like the of Joy and Healing. There's a book that I have up in the chalet called the Joy and Healing, and it says something that Christian joy ought to have an effect on your life status. But that particular subject as a classroom entity is going to be worked in. It is not possible to do that other than what I'm going to do next week. Sort of tangential to the subjects that I'm going to be doing, but we're going to be working those concepts in as per the statement.
Jim?
Yeah.
Did you have a question?
What's just the statistics, isn't it, that is it 50% or 60% of the health care dollars are spent in the last 6 months of a person's life?
Oh, more than that.
Is that over 2/3?
Of hospital care.
Yeah, of hospital.
Of hospital care, it's even more. It's about 70% are spent. And it's mostly, it's the last month.
Okay. 63% of the people, as of the last statistics, now out of date, 63% of the people who died in the United States died in the hospitals. And that's because, and we took people to the hospital for the last, even last 3 days. Now we have hospice. We're not afraid to let people die in the long-term care institution, so the statistics are being affected.
We are, but we're hopefully having a better discussion about the options.
Of the options, and not dumping them in and collecting a big bill for Medicare for the last 3 days. Okay, well, we're past the time, and we're sort of, if you want to stay, Lee and I are right here, so we'll be happy to talk to you, okay?